This is the start of the August 8th, 1986 interview with retired fisherman and party boat captain Albert Gufford of Mayport, Florida. The interviewer is David Taylor, and this interview is done in connection with the Maritime Heritage Survey Project. To begin by asking you, when were you born?
Born in 1904, August 26, 1904.
And where were you born?
Dublin, Georgia.
Whereabouts is Dublin?
Dublin is about 60 miles from Macon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rather small country town, tobacco farming mostly.
What was your father's name?
Joseph Gufford.
Mm-hmm. Were there many children in your family?
There was eight.
Wow. Whereabouts did you fit in age-wise?
I'm number three.
Mm-hmm. What did your father do for a living?
My father was a general contractor and a sawmill owner.
Oh, yeah. So he built buildings as well as ran the sawmill?
Right.
What did you think you wanted to be when you were growing up?
I didn't want to be a carpenter from working with my father. I worked with him for 3 years, and I never could even learn to saw a straight line. So I definitely did not want to be a carpenter. I couldn't build anything. I'm frank with you. I'm just no good with wood.
What did you do as you, I presume you went to school there in Dublin?
Oh, yes. No. We moved from Dublin when I was only 3 years old. We moved to Jacksonville. And we lived in Jacksonville for about 2.5 years. And then my father went back and got a contract in Macon, Georgia with the Case Fowler Lumber Company to rebuild their mill.
Mm-hmm.
So we went back to to Macon, and he rebuilt the mill. It's a 2-year job. And from there, we moved to a town that no longer exists, Lukens, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It was named, my father named it Lukens. He was set up a sawmill there to cut cypress that was cut up along the Suwannee River and rafted over to his mill. And there was an old gentleman he was a retired fisherman, a disabled fisherman rather, that lived on the island there for, oh God, there's no telling how many years. And he named the town for Mr. Lukens.
How do you spell Lukin?
Lukens.
Mm-hmm.
Lukens. It's near Cedar Keys. It's about 4 miles from Cedar Keys. It was what it was just a little high place in a marsh that was accessible by water where my father had the sawmill.
Oh, yeah.
He had his own, he brought in all of his own help. 90% of his help was black people. He built houses for them on the higher grounds. And he had that sawmill until 1913, in fact. And we had a tidal wave over there that destroyed, he lost all of his lumber, lost about 30 million board feet of lumber. And he destroyed the sawmill also. So he left there and went to Winter Park, moved to Winter Park. And there he went into contracting business, building houses. And he did that until 1916, I guess. And then he got a job with the Navy, supervisor of shipbuilding. They were building subchasers in a shipyard in Brunswick, also building subchasers here in Jacksonville and one place in Charleston. And he was overseer of the three places. He traveled. We lived here in Jacksonville, and he traveled from place to place.
Now, were you and the rest of the family with him in Lukens and these other locations?
That's right.
Too?
That's right.
It's quite an entourage to
bring.
Yeah.
Well, And we moved from Brunswick, where we finally, while he was working with the Navy in that shipbuilding business, he decided that he wanted to move to back to Jacksonville. And I had an uncle that worked for my father. My father had about 140-acre farm in Brunswick, 3 miles out from Brunswick, a place called Chapel Crossing. And he decided he wanted to move back to Florida again. So he got a contract with some brush company. I don't know if it was Fuller Brush or who it was, but they cut palmetto logs and took the fiber out of them to make brushes out of.
To make what?
Brushes.
Brushes, huh?
Scrub brushes, uh-huh. And we left Brunswick with, we had an Overland sedan, we had a Saxon Roadster, we had 2 real trucks, and one Cadillac, a 2-cylinder Cadillac. We left Brunswick, and when we got down to Maitland, Florida, where we moved to, it took us 17 days to make the trip. The only paved road that was in this area at all was part of Main Street in Jacksonville. About 2 miles of Main Street in Jacksonville was paved. Then there was a little, about a mile and a half paved on in South Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. And we headed down the coast, and you'd come to a little town, and maybe you had 2 blocks of pavement. And the rest of it was rutted roads. That's why it took us so long to travel, because one or two of the cars were always stuck. It was a deep rut. You were running in deep ruts, and you'd get stuck along the way. We camped out at night, always stopped about 2 hours before dark, and the men folks went out and hunted for fresh meat for supper. Squirrel, turkey, deer, whatever was available. And we went on down to Maitland, and as I say, my father had a contract with this brush company for this fiber, and he did that for about 3 years, I guess. And he said it was just boring, staying in the swamp, doing nothing but cutting palmetto logs.
Yeah.
So he decided he would get out of that business. So he did get out of it, and he went to put his trucks to hauling fruit. Then for the American fruit growers, they had a packing house there at Maitland. And he did that for 1 year, and that still didn't cut with him, that's all. He just didn't care for it. So he saw in the paper a store advertised in Tampa, Florida, for sale. So he sent my eldest brother, whom is passed away now, he was former justice of the peace in this area, sent him down there to look the store over and see if the how much business we're doing, check the books and everything else. And my brother closed the deal for the store while he was down there. So we moved down there and stayed down there till 1921, I guess. And my father moved to Miami. That's when the land boom was starting in the lower part of Florida. So he moved to Miami. And he was in the construction business, house building business there. He was also buying and selling real estate at the same time. I didn't live with him down there. I didn't go with him down there. I was out on my own by this time and going to sea. And he stayed there at that grocery store for about 4 years. And he decided he wanted to, had an opportunity to buy a mill near Dublin, Georgia. So he went back there and bought the sawmill and operated the sawmill until, I don't really remember the year, it's been so long ago. But for several years. Then he went back to Miami again. And he stayed there until the crash of the stock market. He had accumulated, I guess, $1 million, and had property that he was buying, and he had binders on, or else he had already bought and was making monthly payments on. It was investment to resell, you know, because real estate turned over sometimes 3 times a day down in one piece of real estate. So he made quite a lot of money there, and that hurricane hit there in 1929 and wiped him out completely. Well, it wiped out, I guess, 2/3 of the property owners in Miami that didn't have their property free and clear. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them that had it free and clear, they had no property after that except land because the buildings were gone. Mm-hmm. So from there, in 1931, I don't remember definitely which year, that he was broke, absolutely broke. So I went down to visit him, saw the condition they're in. My father had a broke shoulder that he got during the hurricane. And I suggested, I was in Mayport at that time. By this time I was in Mayport fishing. I suggested he move to Mayport. So I had a Chevrolet truck that I had driven down there. I gave him the Chevrolet truck. I came back by train, and they got everything ready and moved up here. And it was really tough back in those days. It was really tough. If you made $6 or $8 a week, you were making good money. You could live very easily on it. He rented a house out in East Mayport. And fishing at that time wasn't very good, but crabbing was good, and there was two crab plants here that picked crab meat. So my father decided he would go crab fishing. Nobody had ever used trot lines. By trot lines, as a long lines, they were 150 feet long with drops of about 12 to 18 inches long with bait on it. Mm-hmm. And he would take the line and pull himself along there with his batteau and dip the crabs with a dip net and put them in the boat. And he sold those crabs for 1 penny a pound. Mm-hmm. He got 200, 300, some days 400 pounds of crabs. That woke a lot of people up in Mayport. They were sitting around grumbling because they couldn't make any money. And my father had always been a very good provider. And he was a man with a little foresight, too. So he did that for approximately 2 years. He got a little money ahead. My mother decided that we should go in the devil crab business and the crab meat business. So Papa figured out that the best thing to do with that, if you're really going to make money, is deliver them to the people. So he started a route out in Riverside. And for about 8 years, they'd made money that you wouldn't believe, making double crabs, and all he could haul about, oh, I'll say 60 dozen at a time is all his car would, he could put in his car without maybe damaging the crabs, you know.
How did he go about selling them?
He just took some crabs, took 3 or 4 dozen, went to Riverside, to the better part of Riverside, knocked on the door, mm-hmm. and asked them if they would like to try a real good double crab. And it went over big. It just went over with a bang. And they could not produce enough devil crabs. He had 2 days a week, Tuesdays and Fridays, that he went to Jacksonville with devil crabs. Then he started him a route down at the beach down here. Also sold a few fish down there,
yeah,
along with the devil crabs and the crab meat. And he did that for another... Well, until 1938, I guess. So he bought a fish house, that right back of the Right Spot restaurant. Mm-hmm. Bought a dock down there. There was an old shack of a fish house. So he built him a 2-story building down there and lived upstairs over the building. Mm-hmm. They run the market. They discontinued their Riverside business because this place down here was a wholesale plus a retail place. My mother couldn't take care of it by herself. So he continued the beach, selling at the beach, going down there twice a week. People would call orders in to him, and he'd know exactly what to bring them, what quantity and what quality, and what kind of fish we wanted. So he did that until 1941, I guess. Yeah, 1941. And the Army and the Navy had drafted all the fishermen around here. There was no fishermen left to fish. So he went to Cedar Key, Florida, and bought a fish house in Cedar Key. He run that fish house over there until 1943, I guess, 1944. Then he moved to a little town. It was just a small fishing village now, called Yankeetown, Florida, over on the Gulf Coast. He opened up a fish house there. And when I got out of service, I decided that I wanted to go in the fish business myself, so I bought my father out. His health was beginning to fail a little bit, and mother's was too. So I went over and bought them out, run that for 2 years, went through a divorce, and just my baby brother had nothing to do, and he was working around the fish house for me. So I just told him that one day after I went through my divorce, I'd met another girl, and we intended to get married. And I just called him one day, told him, "Warren, come down, I want to talk to you." I says, "I've got a GI loan. I got the first GI loan was ever obtained in Jacksonville after I got out of service." So I bought my father out, and I stayed down until I went through my divorce, and then I decided I wanted to get out of it. This girl that I had met, she knew nothing about the fish business and probably didn't want to know. And we got married. I gave her the place to my brother. I said, "I've got a GI loan on this place. I still owe him $900. You pay the $900 off and the fish business is yours." And I had 12 boats, trout boats, with little air-cooled inboard engines in them that I probably only had $5,000 in the whole thing, but I wanted to get out of it. I had a little money. I wanted to get out of it. I'd made big money over there because right after the war, the last part of the war there, you could sell anything you could catch, you could sell it. There was a ready market for it. I think that was due to the fact that so many people in service ate fish and shrimp that they had never eaten before. 90% of the men from up north that came down to the south and was in the Navy had never eaten a shrimp before in their life. And they went wild over them. They were good. And that's the reason that the shrimp industry is as large as it is today is due to World War II and the men that had never had access to fresh seafood before started eating seafood. The only fish they probably ever had was something they caught in a lake or a stream or something somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
Some kind of fish, pike, rainbow trout or something like that.
Yeah. Or got out of a can.
That's right. And it introduced them to fresh seafood. And that's the reason that the seafood business is where it is today. I credit the World War II with it being as tremendous as it is today, which it's... Today, it's not near as good as it was a few years back because of the fact that after the war, when you could sell anything that you could get, people started building bigger boats. And they all used to pull one net. Now they pull up to four, some up to six. They started building bigger boats, bigger power, and consequently, they just almost destroyed the shrimp beds. Mm-hmm. Dragging, continuously dragging, 24 hours a day. And they darn near depleted all the shrimp. As you know, we're having a struggle right here now.
Sure. What was the name of your father's fish house?
That he Gufford's had? Gufford's here. Fish House.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you were telling me about deviled crab. How did he make, or he and his and your mother make deviled crab? What would go into making them?
That would be bread, of course. You had a bread for a filler. Bell pepper, onion, salt, and pepper. And they had one secret ingredient they put in that I don't even know about. I have never known it.
Is that common for companies or families to have a secret recipe?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Oh, definitely.
What, did they sell them in a particular type of container at that time?
No, they didn't. They put them on trays and covered the trays over. Back in those days, you didn't have access to foil or saran wrap or anything else. They covered them over with a newspaper.
Yeah.
And took them and delivered them.
I see in many markets today that they put this mixture in the crab shell. Is that what they did too?
That's right. It was in the crab shell.
And then you would bake that and it would be ready
That's
to
serve? Right. You baked it or deep fried either one.
Oh, yeah.
They baked all of theirs, but most people today deep fry them.
Hmm.
Which, as far as I'm concerned, it's just a little too much grease.
Yeah, I'd say so, too.
It absorbs so much grease so it isn't, it just isn't as healthy as baked foods were. There was absolutely no grease in those that my mother turned out, mm-hmm. where today they're all fried, deep fried, and they have a lot of cholesterol in them.
Yeah.
You can believe
yeah.
that.
You were telling me quite a lot about your father's career and how he came from doing contracting and in mill work into fisheries operations. How did you yourself get involved with going on the water?
Well, water always fascinated me. It always fascinated me. So in 1928, I decided I wanted to be a fisherman. At that time, I was back in Brunswick, Georgia. And I got a hold of a boat by the name of Beth. It belonged to a crab company in Brunswick. And in the fall of the year, we would come down here to fish because the shrimping was good here and it wasn't good in Brunswick. So I come down here and I fished two winter seasons down here. Fall and early winter. And I went back to Brunswick, quit the boat, decided I wanted to move to Mayport. So I did. I moved to Mayport. I fished for 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, and it gets boring and I want to do something else. The first time I left here, I went to Miami, and there was advertising for a captain on a yacht down there. The yacht belonged to H.K. Sloot from Mexico City. It was an 80-foot, 1-foot yacht that he had bought up in City Island, New York, and he had to have somebody go up there and bring it back. So I contacted him by telephone, made arrangements, and I met him in New York, brought the boat back down to Miami, intercoastal, of course, and the boat was formerly owned by the City of New York for entertaining dignitaries. And what he paid for it, I don't have any idea. But I went back, took it back to Miami, to the Miami Yacht Base on the Miami River. The boat needed refinishing very badly. It was all mahogany and all varnished work. So I contracted with him to do the varnish work, to refinish the boat. And I stripped it all down to the bare wood and sanded it. Refinished that boat. I spent over a year refinishing that boat. Then he hired me as a permanent captain, and he wanted the boat to go to Orange, Texas. They owned several dredges in Mexico. They did all the dredging for the Mexican government. So this yacht he wanted as a play toy. He just married. This young Smoot had just married. His father lived in Mexico City, but he didn't. He lived in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the boat around to Orange, Texas. And that was back in the day when we had no navigation aids except the sextant. and with no more education I had, I didn't know how to use a sextant. I got charts, and with a yardstick, I left Miami and drew my course with a yardstick from point to point, and I never missed a point more than 8 or 10 miles, always within sight.
Yeah.
And in fact, most of the people did their navigating that back in those days that way. We didn't have protractors and anything but a sextant, and we didn't know how to use a sextant.
Yeah.
You had to go to school to learn that.
Yeah.
So I stayed with him for about 2 years, and they had found shrimp off the Louisiana and Texas coast. So on my way to Orange, Texas, I'd met a bunch of the Florida boys from here and from St. Augustine that was fishing out of Morgan City, Louisiana. So I went into Morgan City, and it looked so good. They was making $150 and $200 a week, which was, man, was big money. I went back, stayed with the, well, I'd been with the man about year and a half then, and I told him, I says, I want you to replace me. I'm going to go in some other phase of the business. I'm going fishing, back to fishing. So I did. I quit, went back to Morgan City, fished there until 1941, when we was getting involved in the world in World War II. I had been in the Coast Guard when I was just a kid. I only stayed in 8 months. Back in those days, when you went in service, if you wanted to buy out any time, you had to enlist for 3 years. If you wanted to buy out, get out at any time, all you had to do is pay for the clothes that you still had. They furnished all your clothes back in those days. And your total base pay was $17 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And you paid the remaining balance on those clothes, and they would give you an honorable discharge.
At any time?
At any time.
Really?
Any time after 6 months.
Yeah.
If you decided you didn't like it or wanted to go into something else, they would do that. So I got out of the Coast Guard, and I didn't know what I really wanted to do. I thought I wanted to run whiskey from the islands.
Oh, yeah.
And I got involved in that for 2 trips. And I got the pants scared off of me. I almost got caught. And if I'd have got caught, I'd have went to the penitentiary.
Hmm.
So I decided that was not for me.
What island?
We'd go to West End. West End.
Yeah.
Over in Bahamas.
Yeah.
We'd go to West End. That's where most of the boats haul whiskey from. It was the closest place, you know. And back in those days, our boats didn't make, the fastest boats we had back in those days was 15 miles an hour. And most of them were 6 and 7 mile an hour boats. I was fortunate enough to get a fast boat. And I almost got my tail in a crack, but good.
What happened?
Well, the Coast Guard almost caught me.
Mm.
I put the boat on the jetties at Miami and swum ashore. It was in shallow water where they could not come in, and they didn't know who it was, and they couldn't come in, and I swam ashore. And I decided then that I didn't want any more bootlegging. So I came back to Mayport and went back to fishing again. And, I got a little ahead of my story there and behind on some of it, too. But that was in 1926 or 27, that I got involved with the Coast Guard and then got involved with whiskey running after that. And I decided the best thing I could do is get me some legitimate work. So I came back to Mayport, went back to fishing again. And I'd stay here, say, for 5, 6 years, get bored with it. Fishing get bad and you wasn't making much money, I'd go out and do something else. And after I got out of service and bought my father out, my father's business out, I then gave this fish business to my brother, and I got a job with a man by the name of Martin G. Williams, whom was a very prominent realtor, an extensive property owner in Jacksonville Beaches.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me just a minute. Wanna...
End of side one. Interview continued on side two. This is the start of side two of the first tape of the August 8, 1986 interview with Albert Gufford of Mayport.
Okay.
He came down to Mayport one day. He'd built a fishing camp out on Cusick Lake, just west of the Intercoastal Waterway on Beach Boulevard. And he didn't have anybody to run it that knew anything about it. So he came down. I was down at Strickland's. That time I was running a party boat called the Americana. I'd just been running it about 4 months. He came down and made me such a good proposition that I couldn't turn it down. He said, I'll give you 50% of it if you come and operate it. Made the deal with him and went out there. Run the fishing camp for about 2.5 years. And the outboard business was coming in big back in those days. It was 1955. So we decided we'd go in the outboard motor business and boat business. We built a building out, a small building out there, and went into it. Now, the first motor that we handled was Scott Atwater, which was the worst motor in the United States. It was the only deal we could get, the only franchise we could get.
That was the name of the engine, Scott Atwater?
Uh-huh, Scott Atwater.
I've never heard of that one.
Scott Atwater. Then we went to Mercury. We got a Mercury dealership. And back in those days, Mercury was a good motor if you run it every day. But if you let it lay up for a month at a time, it had so much aluminum in it that it would eat the salt water that was left in the engine, would just literally eat the engine up. So, we first went in the outboard business. We applied Johnson to get a Johnson dealership. Well, after, I guess it was 1957 is when we got the Johnson dealership. So then we built a big showroom and repair place out on Beach, right on Beach Boulevard. We had this other down at the waterfront where the beach, the fishing camp was, so I could look after both of them. Mr. Williams had concessions on the boardwalk, and he was in the real estate business, and he was a real estate appraiser. So he didn't take any interest in the place at all, come out once a week for a little while. So I run that place until, was in the outboard business until 1963, and my health got bad. I had ulcers in a very advanced stage. They had been operated on once before. And I just got to where I was a nervous wreck, so I just had to take time off. So I did. I took time off and went to the VA hospital in Gainesville. Stayed over there 4 months, and they got me pretty well straightened out. Well, when I got back, Mr. Williams had a buyer for the place because I'd already told him I would come home occasionally on the weekend while I was over there. They'd give me a weekend pass, you know. I'd come home and I'd told him that the doctors didn't want me to be tied up in anything that was tiring and something that aggravated me. And that it was aggravating because some of the customers you had would drive you up the wall. They'd buy a new piece of equipment. You'd tell them how to handle it, how much gasoline to put in the oil. They'd go and get gasoline and forget to put the oil in. They'd burn the motor up and come back and say, well, your motor's no good. Then you had to fight the factory. Well, the factory knew the story. I knew the story. But still, we wanted to keep those customers. And many and many powerhead, we've made good when we possibly know that the person had forgot to put oil in it. Mm-hmm. Or hit a log or something with the lower unit and ripped the whole lower unit off and they claimed it was a fault in the motor.
Yeah.
So one thing went to another, and I just did not go back. And he sold the place. Our understanding was, when I went out there with him with the fishing camp, anything that the fishing business developed into would be 50% mine, 50% his. So when we closed the fishing camp out, we had 100 boats. We sold our boats, sold all the equipment we had. We split it right down the middle. It was only a gentleman's agreement,
yeah.
Nothing in writing at all. So when it went in the outboard business, that went into a lot of money. He put up the initial money to open the place with, to build a building and open the place with. And we paid it off. And in about 3 years' time, we paid it off. So I assumed that when he sold, because he always said when he got to where he couldn't be out there occasionally, you know, that my health went bad or anything. We just didn't like each other anymore. We'd sell the place and split it down the middle. Well, when I came back from the hospital and told him that I couldn't work anymore, I was going to take a couple of years off. He says, well, I've got the place sold. So we sat down and went over figures. I took an inventory of all the parts we had, all the equipment we had in the repair shop, tools, hoist lifts and everything else, and went over it, and he made the man the price on the property and the building and the business, less the equipment. So I inventoried all the equipment, all the parts and everything else, and we came up with a figure. So I had to go back. I got an extra 3 days off, Monday and Tuesday and Wednesdays, from the VA hospital to make this inventory. So I went on back to the hospital, and when I got back to the hospital, I stayed there for 3 weeks. And my wife called me one evening, and she says, Mr. Williams sold the business. I said, well, good, that's good. We'll have enough to live on very comfortably for the next 15 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I sold the place for $271,000, and half of that was supposed to be mine, see. So I got another leave from the hospital and come home. And the man wouldn't even speak to me when I got back. I never got a dime out of it, not one penny. As hard as I'd work in 12 and 15 hours a day. And he'd maybe come out there for 3 or 4 hours a day some days. I really got a good hosing on that job. That gentleman's agreement I found is not always. Well, I tell you, when I was a young man, you shook hands with a man on a deal, his word was his bond. But today I found out in that deal right there that a gentleman's agreement is not worth a damn anymore. Absolutely not.
What was the name of that company and the name of the fishing
camp? Martwill Marine.
What was it again?
Martwill Fishing Camp first, and then it developed into the Martwill Marine. His name was Martin Williams, so he named it Martwill. I had a very fine relationship with the old man. He was really nice. We did a lot of fishing together, and I thought he was just as honest as the days were long. But really, I don't think that he did that on his own. He was getting rather feeble. And he had a son that had been to college, and went in the Army, served 3 years in the Army, and came back, and he was taking over his father's real estate business. And I think the son talked him into giving me the deal that I got.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was money hungry.
Yeah.
Really money hungry.
Yeah. That's too bad.
Yep.
Certainly didn't help you feel better after getting out of the hospital.
It certainly didn't. It definitely didn't. But fortunately, I had a little money.
Yeah.
I was never a spendthrift in my life. I never believed in throwing a dollar away, going in bars and drinking up $100 worth of whiskey in a night or anything like that. I just didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
I like a drink. I like a drink as well as anybody in the world. But I like a drink before dinner, and that's the end of my drinking.
Yeah.
I'm not a drinker, a heavy drinker or anything like that.
I'd like to go back a little bit and talk about when you first learned about fishing in Brunswick.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about picking up the knowledge that you needed to...
By working with somebody else on another boat. I worked for about 6 months to learn the business, learn how to fix nets, how to make nets, how to fish, where to fish. We fished all up and down the coast. And that's how I got my knowledge, is by getting out there on deck and busting my fanny on deck.
What were the boats and gear like then? What kind of stuff were you using?
I didn't quite get...
What were the boats like in terms of size and power?
Well, a 38-foot boat was a big boat back in those days. Most of them were 25, 28 feet long. And your bigger boats were... Well, if you got a boat 36 feet long, you had a battleship. Mm-hmm. You had a battleship. And we never fished far from port. We fished where we could go in with a matter of 2.5 or 3 hours. And when we wanted, like when we came from Brunswick to Mayport, we came intercoastal. We did not go outside because boats was not built for outside work to take weather in case you got caught.
Did they have... The pilot house arranged as these boats are today?
Almost identical. Yeah. Almost identical. There's been a lot of improvements on it, you know. Now most of your pilot house is round where it was kind of octagon shaped before.
Mm-hmm. What kind of engines would you have?
Mostly in those days we had Lathrop. Lathrop was the most popular engine, fishing engine in those days. It was a two-cycle engine. And they did come out in 1934-35 with a four-cycle engine. It was with a 40 horsepower and a 65 horsepower. And a lot of the fishermen changed to those, but the original engine we started with was a two-cycle engine, and it burned diesel fuel. You started it up on gasoline, and then it would start burning the diesel fuel after that. It was a two-cycle engine rather than a four-cycle engine. And a lot of the fishermen back in those days that built their own boats, and they wound up putting automobile engines in them. You could go to the junkyard, and a Buick 6 was a favorite engine back in those days. You could go to a junkyard and buy one of those engines for $10. What you do is come down and set it in the boat and line it up. And if it burned up on you, you always bought two or three of them. You kept a couple extra ones on the dock. All right, if you burnt one up today, you come back, and in a matter of 3 hours, you had your engine changed. You roll the other one over, went out in the river, and roll the other one overboard. Mm-hmm. And that was a...
Did they put on any kind of reduction gear then?
No, there was no reduction gear. Wow. Then. No reduction. Everything was straight drive.
Yeah. It must have been pretty high RPM.
Until the 40 and the 65... Lathrop came out with four cycle, then they started with reduction gears.
Yeah. What kind of deck gear did you have, winches and things of that nature?
We only had, back in those days, in the earlier days, we only had one shaft coming out of the back end with a spool on it. And that's the way you pulled your nets in, on the spool. Mm-hmm. We used all rope tow lines back in those days, where they use steel cable now. And they got three drum winches now, where we didn't have those. We just had one drum back there. Hmm. And that's what we pulled our nets in with.
Did you have the booms, or was it outriggers, they call them?
No, we didn't have outriggers, because you didn't need outriggers dragging with a single rig. Mm-hmm. You had one short one. That was mostly on the right-hand side of the boat as you face the front of the boat, was on your right hand side.
Yeah.
It had you had a boom out there about 8 feet long that you put your swung your doors out on. And then you throw your net overboard and it dragging behind you until you get your net all straightened out, and then you started on these tow lines on this winch, you got it wrapped around the winch, and you start slowly easing off on that until you get your doors in the water. And then you would watch your net and make sure that your doors had opened properly, and then you would start letting your line out a little faster until you got the amount of line. Your line was measured and had every 4 or 5 fathoms, you had a marker on it. Mm-hmm. of different colors, and you knew how much water you were in and how much toline you had to put out.
Did you use Trinets then?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, we used Trinets. Mm-hmm.
How large were the big nets that you had?
Well, back in those days, I guess about a 50-foot net was as large as anybody pulled. One net.
That's 50 foot across the mouth?
That's right. Okay. Mm-hmm. 50 foot spread.
Were those types of nets known by any particular name?
Just a shrimp net is all.
Yeah. Were mm-hmm. there many different designs?
Not back in those days there wasn't. There is now.
Yeah.
There's 7 or 8 different design nets now. There's flat nets, butterfly nets. Mongoose nets, and a lot of people, a lot of fishermen, individually themselves, will come up with a net. They'll try experience with nets and find that it catches better. Well, you never learn what that man did to that net because he won't tell you. And you couldn't go and look at the net hanging in the rigging and tell what he'd done to it. But when one boat started out catching everybody else, then you knew that man had come up with something. Mm-hmm. But he didn't tell you. You never found that out unless you started experimenting yourself.
Yeah.
Or maybe got one of his crewmen, bought him a half a pint of shine, or and he would tell you what was happening.
Uh-huh.
But that's the only way you found out, because I don't blame the fisherman mm-hmm. that came up with something that he could make more money with. I don't blame him at all.
Yeah. I know, there's a net house right across here, and there are some in other places, too. Was that common when you started in, that there would be professional net makers with net shops?
No, not really. Most every fisherman made his own nets. You always had a few elderly people that had quit fishing that still made nets that you could get them to make a net for you. But most all fishermen made their own nets. Mm-hmm. You did not have net houses like you do today.
Were the materials for making nets different from what they are today?
No, same materials.
What about taking care of them? Did you have to do anything different as far as upkeep, taking care of the nets? Anything different you had to do then?
Not really. Back in those days, your nets were all tarred. And they were stiff as a board. But when you get them in the water, why, of course, they spread and it stretches all the mashes out. But today they dye nets. Most of them are green. All the dyes green. I see he's got one hanging up in the rigging down there now, drying. But it's a solution that doesn't get hard, doesn't make your webbing hard. That's rough on your fingers when you're handling that net and that stuff is tarred and real stiff and cut your fingers all to pieces.
How often would you have to tar the net?
About twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
It all depended on how regularly you fished, how much you fished. When your net begins to get limp, real limp, back in those days your nets were made out of cotton. Today they're made out of nylon.
So when you were fishing out of Brunswick, what was your fishing area? How far south or north would you go?
Cumberland Island was as far south as I came, and about 10 miles north of Brunswick. You never got over 10 miles from port,
mm-hmm.
because, as I said, the boats were small, weren't well built in those days, and you was where it would only take you a couple of hours, you could get in port. And if you saw a real black crowd building up, you picked up then regardless of what you was catching and headed for port.
Mm-hmm. Earlier you were talking about navigating using a chart. Are there other ways that that fishermen, before they had electronic gear, used to find their way or to come upon the same fishing ground that they had fished before?
It was all dead reckoning back in those days, and a man that was fishing regular in the same area, or if he was fishing all the way up and down the coast, he learned his courses from the sea buoy at each port to a certain fishing ground, whether he was snapper fishing or shrimp fishing. He had those courses up here. He didn't have them written down. Mm-hmm. Somebody might steal them. So he had them up here.
Did you ever use landmarks to help you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
How would you go about doing that?
Well, you'd find you were fishing where you were fishing, and you were catching good shrimp, and it was good bottom that you could drag on without tearing your nets up. Then you'd start looking ashore, and you'd find two objects that would line up where you were fishing. And that's the way you learned where to drag. And they still do that today, although they have all this sophisticated electronics things. They still use landmarks to line up the fish on.
Why do you think they still do that, even though they have Loran and that kind of stuff?
Because Loran is very accurate. Today it's very accurate, but you just can't. You're fishing around a pile of rock, and you drag in and out of these rocks. With a Loran, you can't do that. It's not that accurate that you won't hang your nets up. But if you keep watching those, you'll have, say, four or five landmarks for dragging in the rocks here, and you get inside, and then you look, and you get it. When you get, watch, you keep on dragging until you line up another set of marks, and you know it's time to turn, and you turn. And then you line up another set of marks to come out of there and to drag out and pick up. Hmm. But they still use landmarks today.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Now, what about reading the bottom or determining the depth of water before depth sounders?
We had a sounding lead. We had a lead that was hollowed out in the bottom, and we used octagon soap. And we threw that lead line, got our depth of water. The first thing we do is find the depth of water we was in. You didn't have to have soap in it then. But to find out the bottom, the kind of bottom, you put octagon soap in it and let it go to the bottom, and then you'd get it straight up and down. The captain would stop the boat, get it straight up and down, bounce it a couple of times, pick it up and look at it and read the bottom.
Now, this soap was like a hard bar soap or something?
That's right. It was hard bar soap, and it was yellow. And if it was sand bottom, then you got sand in it. If it was, shell bottom, you'd pick up shell. If it was coral, you'd pick up a piece of coral in it.
Mm-hmm. And what type of bottom was best for finding shrimp?
Shrimp and mud bottom. Mm-hmm. Mud bottom is where your shrimp are. Or snapper fishing, you want to look for coral reefs.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what about looking at different aspects of the weather or the clouds or the water to tell about where to fish or when to fish? Did any of that come into play?
Not really. Not really. You watch the weather, of course. You had a barometer. That was about the only navigational gear you had with a barometer. And you watch that barometer real close. Yeah, the barometer started falling real fast. You got yourself home. Mm-hmm. You started heading for home right quick.
Were there certain weather conditions that were better for fishing than others?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. A westerly wind is not very good for shrimping or for snapper fishing. If it blows westerly wind more than one day, well, you might as well rack it up until that wind came around to the eastern. Because it muddies the water up. With westerly wind, muddies the water up. And the shrimp bury up on you. They'll go right down in the mud themselves. Hmm.
Did the behavior of birds or any other types of fish ever give you any information about things?
You better believe that. When you saw birds way up here in the air, I mean way up there, just keep circling, it was not going anywhere, just circling and making a complete circle,
yeah.
And you stay up there for more than 10 minutes at a time, then you know to go home because there was a good northeaster coming.
Hmm.
That was your best indication. When you saw those birds up there circling, mister, you better come home. They've saved many a life.
Hmm. What about, I don't know, like dolphins or sharks or any fish movements or anything like that?
Not really. No, not really.
Yeah.
No, you couldn't tell by the fish moving or the movement of the fish or even one other good indication of weather was when you were shrimping, if you started catching shrimp with their legs just blood red, you knew to watch the weather and watch it very close because you were fixing to have either a strong northeaster or a strong southeaster. Their legs will turn just as red as fire.
I've never heard about that before.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Their legs turn just as red as fire. You know you're in for a spell of bad weather.
Were there other kinds of theories that, that fishermen had about how the shrimp moved, like when they were close or when they moved off?
Right. Some of the fellows, it was uncanny. Now, Walter Floyd, he formerly owned two party boats here. He was a big man in the party boat business, and he got tangled up with the wrong people. Associating with the wrong people, and he lost everything in the world he had. But it was uncanny. He shrimped and party fished. In the wintertime, he fished. Fall of year, in wintertime, he fished. In the summertime, he carried parties. And he was good. He knew that bottom out there. I mean, he could go out, he hit that sea buoy, and he wouldn't tell you where he was going at all until he got to the sea buoy. And he said, I think we'll run down here to the Turtle Grounds, or we'll go to the Demanche Grounds, or we'll go to Middle Grounds, go to the Hospital Grounds. And that man, he was, I don't know, he had the best memory, I guess, of any fisherman I ever knew in my life. He would leave, he'd never leave a jug buoy or a large buoy that could be seen by another boat. He could leave the end of the jetties and run for 2 hours. Say we'd been out fishing the day before. We'd found good fish. We left good fish there. So we're going to go back to it tomorrow or day after tomorrow. He took a piece of hanging twine, net hanging twine, which was a small twine, and put about 2 pound weight on it and a fishing cork at the end of the line so it was just about this far under the water. Nobody...
3 inches or so,
right. Nobody could see it.
Yeah.
But he could leave that sea buoy and run to it. When he run his running time out, he'd tell you, look over the side there. It ought to be just about on the bow right now. You look down there, and 99 times out of 100, it was there.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
That's right. He used to do that to the other party boats. They'd find good fish, see. Well, he'd come in there and know that we had found good fish. He'd come in and fish a while himself. And most of them, one of us was not as accurate with our navigation as Walter Floyd was. Well, that's why I say he was uncanny. He'd come in there, and you wouldn't see him do it, but he'd put that sunken buoy down there. And the next morning, I guarantee he's going to leave 30 minutes ahead of you. And when you got there, he was sitting on top of your fish. And there was nothing you could do about it.
How could he find that?
That's what I don't know. I don't know. But he would run his time out. So many minutes or so many hours and so many minutes. And he'd tell you, we ought to see it in another 30 seconds. Pretty soon he'd pull her in reverse. He says, look over there. It's right there. I guarantee you 99 times out of 100, it was there.
Mm.
A brilliant mind.
Yeah.
It was just unbelievable.
Oh, I got to switch the tapes here again.
End of side two of the first tape of the August 8th, 1986 interview with Albert Gufford. Interview continued on tape two.